to students, build a 21st century workforce, and increase degree completion. In this session, we're going to spend a lot more time on the workforce part of our charge. You've got higher ed, workforce development. So we don't have the money in our committee on the workforce side. Senator Tomasoni's committee has the money, but yet we have the charge. It's important for us to approach workforce from the aspect of, are our students, you know, looking at from high school through the pipeline prepared to meet the job needs and to meet their own career objectives in the future? Right now, we have significant amount of state funds, that, and these state funds are derived from primarily businesses, an assessment on their taxes that go into workforce development funds and job skills partnership funds. I think it's important for this committee, even though we don't have jurisdiction over those funds, to understand where that money is really going so that we can be in a position down the road to evaluate, are there changes that we might recommend to that? Are there ways that we think some of those workforce development funds could be targeted to more fulfill the goals and objectives of this committee? So we will spend a good deal of time asking the departments to provide an overview so that we have a thorough understanding of that. In addition, we're going to be talking about a new program this session that we're calling the Pipeline Project. I do have to give Dave credit because he came up with the name, but it stands for Private Investment, Public Education, Labor Industry Experience. And we're looking at that as modeling the German approach, where 70% of students in Germany have a dual track post-secondary experience, where they're coupled with some sort of a business or industry experience as they go through school. So we will be putting forward legislation and recommendations of how we might pilot a Minnesota version of that, understanding our culture is very different, our needs are different. But we will explore that and we'll want your help and your thoughts and your ideas on that. And, of course, as always, any ideas that you have in this committee for things you'd like to initiate, please do share with us and with Dave, and we'll make sure that your ideas are put forward in terms of legislative hearings. So today we're very excited to have a presentation by Complete College America. And so rather than me tell you about Complete College America, I'm going to let the president tell you himself about Complete College America. And so I would ask Stan Jones, the president, and Greg Vandal to come beside or sit at the table as well. Bruce Vandal, excuse me.
Greg's my cousin.
Is he?
Yes.
Because I know him, so that's funny.
Well, thank you, Madam Chairman, members of the committee. Appreciate you taking some time today to hear from us. Just a little background on Complete College America. We started 5 years ago. We really started with support from five foundations. Principally the Gates Foundation and the Lumina Foundation, both of whom had significant efforts underway in terms of helping more students complete college. And we were started to work with states, with governors, with legislators, with key officials within states on policy and practice on encouraging more students to graduate. And so currently we work with 32 states in the District of Columbia, and which you see here, and let's see if I, yeah, okay. And our only purpose is college completion. There's lots of other things that interest us in higher education, but that's our purpose. My own background, just very briefly, is I used to be in the lower house in Indiana, the House of Representatives, for 16 years. I worked for Governor Bayh when he was governor, former United States Senator. And then I was the commissioner for higher education in Indiana for a dozen years before we started this venture. And, Bruce, you want to give a little bit about your Minnesota background at least?
Sure. I'm a born and raised Minnesotan. Before I worked at Complete College America, I worked at Education Commission of the States, but also at the Minnesota Minority Education Partnership, where Representative Carlos Mariani is the executive director.
So in Complete College America, what we've tried to do is to try to identify what we think are the most significant things that can improve college completion, which we call game changers. There are a lot of people doing a lot of things. We could write a book saying 101 things you might do about college completion, but we're not writing that book. We've identified five things that we think can substantially improve college completion, and not in the sense of improving at 5 or 10%, but doubling and tripling the rates of completion or return that we get on these kinds of strategies. So I'm briefly going to go through this. Please feel free to ask questions anywhere along the way as I walk through this. The place where we actually started was metrics, which was kind of an unusual place for us to start. But most states and the federal government do not collect the kind of information that policymakers need. And so we met with 20 different higher education organizations, came up with a simple set of 12 metrics. We disaggregate them based on race and sex and age. And these are pretty important to policymakers. We worked very closely with the National Governors Association, and they adopted these metrics as their own as well. And so as you can see, they're pretty straightforward. Numbers of degrees, graduation rates, how long does it take to complete, how many credits, why are these things important? For example, I can tell you time to complete at most two-year colleges around the country. It takes 4 years for full-time students to get a two-year degree. For most students at community colleges, instead of 60 credit hours, they end up with 80 credit hours before they get a degree. Unless you have these metrics, you wouldn't know that. And so we collect these across 30 states now. We also collect, which we're going to discuss in a minute, how many students complete first year math and English. Why is that important? In many states, as many as 60% of students will start in remedial courses at community colleges. And unless we know whether they're successful in this first math and English course, we won't know what kind of policy, what kind of procedures we ought to be pursuing. So these are pretty straightforward metrics that we collect from 30 states, and it helps the states really help drive policy. Graduation rates, and these are national numbers and not Minnesota numbers, but these are graduation rates, on-time graduation rates in the first section, 19% for 4 years, and 45% for 6 years for the non-flagships. Many of those non-flagships are open admission or semi-open admission universities, and those are the graduation rates. At two-year graduation rates, hardly anybody graduates on time. These also represent full-time students, and after 3 years, about 13%. Remediation, and this is really walks us into one of the first places that is one of our game changers. A lot of people don't know that we have significant numbers of students start in remedial courses, both at the two-year and four-year level. Interestingly, some of us used to think that these were adults coming back that needed brush-up. It's equally as likely that a recent high school graduate will end up in a remedial course, essentially taking courses that they passed in the year before. So we have substantial numbers at both levels. What people don't know is not only do we not have significant numbers, but they don't know that we're basically not very successful with remediation. It doesn't work. Students actually complete the remedial courses, but they don't go on to complete that middle section, the gateway courses, that first math course that they were being remediated for, or their first English course that they were being remediated for. And subsequently, very few of those students that start graduate. As a matter of fact, if you're placed in remedial courses right away, your graduation rate drops in half. Remediation, is as it's currently constituted, does not work, so much so that, for example, let's say the chairperson and I were both referred to remediation, but she figured out a way to skip it and start in a regular college course. She actually would do better than I would do. And the reason is not that the remediation wouldn't help me. I would never even get to that college course. I would be lost along the way. So traditional remediation is really wholly ineffective, and that's really our first focus, our first game changer, as we call that. And so we say think about this differently. Think about remediation not as a prerequisite to starting a college course, but as a co-requisite. Think about helping students not before they get into the college course, but when they start the college course, or just-in-time remediation. This could be simple, like we might be in the same class, but Bruce and I stay 45 minutes after class to work with an instructor or a grad assistant. It could be that rather than a three class periods a week, I go four or five. It could be that I have assigned tutoring. It could be that I have lab time that I'm assigned and scheduled to. So there are lots of different strategies to give students more help when they're in college-level classes. Significant numbers of students can do this and do very well. And the numbers we see in terms of results are really pretty startling. So one of the things that you have to face first is that's developing across the country is mathematics. And when I went to college, and when most people my age went to college, everybody took college algebra. That was what people did. And today it's still true. But our mathematician friends tell us that the only purpose for college algebra is to prepare for calculus. And only 6% of the students in the country take calculus. And so if calculus is not in your program, you shouldn't be taking college algebra. So, for example, if you go into political science, if you go into sociology, if you go into psychology, you need statistics.
Right.
In many other degrees, quantitative reasoning would be a more important mathematics. If you go into the health professions, they need measurement. They need to know how to do formulas. There's no evidence that college algebra helps the first nurse. And so many, especially community colleges, are relooking at their math sequences and coming up with different pathways for students that are more productive. This is how we think differently about remediation. At most community colleges, this is what the data looks like. Significant numbers of students start in remedial courses, and very few start in the regular gateway regular courses. The tests that we use, and most colleges use tests that AccuPlace or Compass, that are $2 tests. I say you get $2 worth of value. They're very unpredictable. Research has been done that anywhere from a third to a half of students have been misplaced. In other words, they could do well in a college-level course, but because they tested poorly, in many cases, they don't know they're going to take a test. They show up for orientation. They say, go down the hallway, take this test. You've been out of school a couple years. Most of us, I wouldn't say which one of us, would not pass that test. And the students find themselves in the same situation. And there are consequences, as we've just discussed. We see a world that looks like this, that there are students that clearly can start without help. There are students that could start in college-level work, but help, as I described earlier. And students that need significant amount of work. These are more students that maybe have sixth or eighth grade level math or English skills. In this situation, if you don't pass the test, the consequences are substantial. You end up in remediation. In this case, if you don't pass the test, the worst thing that happens to you is you start with college and you get help. Not a bad consequence. All of the colleges that we work with that do the kind of remediation that we talk about, putting students in college-level work with support, 45 minutes after class, an additional class, 85 to 90% of the students that typically are referred to remediation can succeed in these college-level classes with help. And they're getting extraordinary results. And just to give you an example, and I've got a lot of examples I could share, and this ranges anywhere from the University of Maryland, College Park, their flagship, where they, even with high admission standards, they have students that were deficient in mathematics. They gave them the test. They took half those students, let them start 5 weeks. For the first 5 weeks, they went every day and took the DevEd course, and then for 10 weeks, they took every day the regular course. After they took the DevEd 5 weeks, they tested the students again. 90% of them passed the test that they had failed 5 weeks earlier. And they all passed at the same rate as other students the regular college course. So these can be dramatically successful. In Indiana, statewide community college, they're implementing this statewide. in English. They've doubled the success rate in English from 25% to 50%. In mathematics, the combination of moving students out of college algebra into statistics and quantitative reasoning and using the co-requisite model, they used to have a success rate of 10% that would actually get through the first level math course. That's now 50% in the course of just 1 year. So these strategies are producing dramatic results. So let me just pause there on remediation. That's really the first game changer, and see if you have any questions. And tomorrow, Bruce will be here with a number of people we brought from other states, working with about 175 faculty members on these kinds of strategies where people have been highly successful. But let me pause, see if people have any questions about the developmental education piece of this.
So can you tell us about the work that you are going to be doing with MinSCU? Is that just an introductory meeting? Have you entered into some sort of a formal agreement? And what do you expect to accomplish?
Sure, Madam Chair. We're really excited to be working with this MinSCU system with Karen Heinrich there. Actually, partly due to the legislation that you all passed last year to administer some of these assessments beginning in high school, the MinSCU system has decided that they need to put more emphasis on those stronger K-12 higher education strategies. And really at the heart of it is this notion that if we do a better job of preparing students in high school by assessing them early, that at the end of the day we should be able to put most of these students that enter our institutions at the very least in a co-requisite strategy. So that, in fact, we could be at a point where there wouldn't be any standalone remediation for students entering in the MinSCU system. So what we're doing tomorrow is working with the 175 faculty. We're bringing in four of the best national experts that we know that have done this and done it very, very well, and to work with the faculty on how they might develop some of these models around delivering academic support as a co-requisite. And we're very excited about this, and we're hoping that this is going to proliferate at all of your campuses, and as a result of that, could see dramatic improvements in Gateway course success. So we're just at the initial point of the conversation. We're hoping that after tomorrow, we'll be able to continue to work with your campuses on this issue.
Very good. Any questions, members? Yes, Senator Klassen.
Yeah, just a comment. You're reinforcing my own experience as a high school principal. I don't know, 10 years ago when they first came out with the statistics and remediation, I was really concerned. So I looked at every single one of our students that they identified, and we found we were graduating classes 560, 570, 85 to 90% of those students were going on to post-secondary. We could only find four students that were attending a four-year college that needed remediation in math. We found one student that had passed the calculus AP exam and had failed the exam and had to take a remediation course. The other thing that the high school math teachers will tell you over and over again, that AccuPlacer is not aligned to the standards that are being taught in high school, but that is the test being given to determine remediation. And I just appreciate the work you've done and your findings. I substantiate what I have found as well. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. The next major issue, and this is really the issue because the first issue, because this is the brick wall students hit first. Just to share another example, this is about students not even getting to the Gateway courses. Achieving the Dream, which is a national organization, collects data from community colleges. Their data says that of the students assigned to mathematics remediation, 70% of them don't even attempt a regular college math course within 2 years. So they don't even get to go. We've lost them before they got to that regular college course. The next major game changer is about time and intensity. And time has two dimensions that we talk about here. One is the length of time that you're there. Some people do need more time and take more time, but the data's been out that, for example, the average four-year student graduation rate after 6 years is about 55%. After 8 years, it's about 58%. So we only picked up 3% more those last 2 years. So I say if you're there at year six, you may be enjoying the dream, but you're not achieving the dream. And you're as likely to drop out as you are to graduate. The other part of it, of graduation, is intensity. And we don't have enough students taking enough credit hours to really graduate. And you can see here, the more credit hours you make in your first year dramatically improves the likelihood that you're going to graduate. It's just really that simple. And I think, yes. And so one of the things that's happened in Indiana, in across the country, is the new norm is 12 credit hours, not 15 or 16. And so on most campuses, we have the majority of students that are full-time taking 12 credit hours, not 15. This is Hawaii on their main campuses. And you can see that many more students were taking the 12 to 14 credit hours, not 15. Well, 12 credit hours, you're already on the five-year plan at best. They put together a campaign to convince incoming freshmen, rather than taking 12 credit hours, to take one more course, take 15. In the course of 1 year, they got that up to 53%. We have 15 states embarking on what we call 15 to finish, getting students to take 15 credit hours that typically took 12. Many universities, there's not additional tuition cost to take 15 rather than 12. There's a banded tuition. But yet students weren't taking advantage of that. And the evidence supports that students that do that, they complete more of their classes, they have a higher GPA, they obviously, more of them graduate, and they graduate more on time. So that's also a significant game changer. By just doing that, we will see significant differences in graduation rates and in on-time graduation rates. The third game changer is what we call GPS, kind of guided pathways for success. To give you a couple examples of how this works, most campuses have had for decades what we call an academic map. It'd be a semester-by-semester plan to graduate. I was an engineering student. We all started in freshman engineering. It was kind of our meta major. And then we got a semester-by-semester plan in civil or mechanical, whatever we were in, all the way to graduation. In many other fields, that's not true. It says you take so many from this grouping, so many from this grouping, and so many from this grouping, and somehow that turns into a degree. Well, so many students are lost along the way. And just to give you just one example, this was my stepdaughter's fiancé, who's 29, good high school student. Parents didn't have money, no encouragement, didn't go to college. 10 years later, decides to go back. So he signs up for classes at the community college. He plans to transfer to the four-year college in Indianapolis. And so he takes five courses. He gets a B average. He signs up for another set of classes. And I say, well, Jeff, what classes are you taking? He said, well, I'm taking political science, and I'm taking this history class and philosophy. I say, well, wait a minute. You're in construction management technology. You can't have that many electives to take. He says, well, okay. So he goes back down to the community college. They have one advisor for every 500 students. He says, I want to transfer to IUPUI, the four-year campus. They say all these courses transfer. So he comes back and says, Stan, they all transfer. I say, yes, they transfer, but they don't transfer into your program. They won't count as credits for your program. They'll count as elective credits. So we finally get him on the program, talk to IUPUI, get him in the right set of courses. In the meantime, he didn't take the math course he needed to take, so that means he can't take a strength of materials course. It means he can't take his physics course. He didn't take his drafting course the first semester, so he can't take his AutoCAD course now. So already, a good student who thought he was doing the right thing, thought he was asking the right questions, he's already backed up at least a semester and maybe longer. And this is not an exception. This is what happens over and over again. And so then this last semester, he says, Stan, I can't get the classes I need, but I need 12 to qualify for the Pell Grant. What do I do? Do I take classes I don't need just to qualify? I said, you better get back down and talk to one of those counselors and get into some of those classes. That also happens over and over again. So this is a different strategy. This is a much more prescriptive strategy. It's helping students determine what major they want to be in, and essentially putting them on a default path. And the best way to describe this, engineering's a good example. We didn't have very many electives. Nursing programs are highly prescriptive. You say, I want to be a nurse, your program's laid out for you. You can't say, I don't like blood. I don't. Can I skip that class or take it the next semester? That's not allowed. You take the courses in the order that they're supposed to be taken in. And so that's what we're proposing for these kinds of students, is really a more prescriptive pathway. And many, many students will appreciate the guidance. Give you one example of success, Georgia State University in Atlanta, Urban University, significant number of African-American students. They've raised their graduation rates substantially over the last 10 years. More importantly, the African-American students, the Hispanic students, the Pell Grant students all graduate at the same rate as the white students. So they virtually eliminated the achievement gap for minority students and low-income students using these strategies. So that's one of our game changers. This is what meta majors look like. This is what academic maps look like. And so we are starting with 8 states working on these academic maps, metro majors, the kind of GPS strategies.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
Yeah. Stan, how many majors do you think, or what type of majors work in this approach? And does this work for four-year school? I mean, how broad are you recommending this?
So, yes. So we're working with in Indiana, Tennessee, and Georgia with a Lumina grant, and we're working with all the public except the flagships, all the public four-year and two-year colleges on this strategy. So it applies to both. Part of it is helping students make choices. And so in many cases, students wouldn't choose their major right away. They wouldn't pick from 200 majors. They would pick what we call a meta major, a large category, STEM, health services, education. And during that first year, then help students pick their majors. But yes, at two-year colleges and at four-year colleges.
Okay, thanks.
And the last significant game changer strategy is the easiest to understand, the hardest for people to get their heads around. And so this is really simple. It's block scheduling. We did a lot of work in Tennessee to start with. They set me up with a lunch with the governor, Governor Bredesen, and I know governors don't have much time, and I know sometimes their attention spans even less than the time they have. So I know I needed to get to my point. So I put a piece of paper on the table between us, and it had two columns. One was the graduation rates for their community colleges, which averaged about 15%. On the other side of the page, Tennessee developed differently. They have one-year colleges that have technical certificates, nursing programs, welding programs, computer science programs, that many, many other community colleges would be at those community colleges. They have a 75% completion rate as compared to a 15% completion rate. So the governor says, well, tell me, I didn't know this. Why is this different? I said, well, the students aren't different. They're about the same age, about the same income level. Actually, there's more minority students going to the tech centers. Yes, they're a little bit more career-oriented, but the real difference is how they go to school. They just go to school 8:30 to 2:30 Monday through Friday. They take attendance, which is an underrated strategy. They go in a cohort, so we would all be in the same class every day. All of that strengthens their commitment. They know how long it's going to take them to graduate. They know what kind of jobs are out there. And there are other examples like this. And so people say, well, Stan, this is Tennessee. That's not us. We're Minnesota. We're different. So you go to New York City, which is pretty far away from Murfreesboro, Tennessee. They have a similar program, a block scheduled program. Those are liberal arts students. 75% of them transfer to four-year college. They have a morning block. They have an afternoon block. Their graduation rate is 55% as compared with 25% for the other community colleges in New York City. Same strategy, different kind of students, different place. So it's not complicated. This is what a block schedule looks like. You could go in the morning, you could go go in the afternoon. They also have an evening block, but you get substantially higher results. Baltimore City Community College is starting this. They have a 3% graduation rate right now. And so they're starting this, and they're going to be highly successful in using this kind of block schedule. So it's pretty simple.
3%? Excuse me, 3% graduation rate.
Most, yeah, I can't speak for Minnesota, but I can tell you Chicago, Philadelphia, Baltimore, D.C., all have graduation rates of about 10% for their community colleges. Urban universities that aren't flagships, maybe 30, 40% graduation rates across the country. So these are pretty similar. So these are this is why we're recommending these kinds of what we call game changers, because we think they've been significant improvements. They've been done in other places in this country, highly successful with different kinds of students. And there's no question that Minnesota is different, but in some respects, you're not different. You face some of the similar challenges that students have. Some of your institutions are similar, and some of them can benefit by some of these strategies that are used across the country. And these aren't hypothetical. These have been put in place on college campuses by faculty members and are showing extraordinary results.
Could you just say a little bit about the report card and why you don't have one for Minnesota?
So is this – did you get this up on the screen or not?
It's not on the screen. It's in people's packets. We have an Indiana report card.
Okay.
And we have a Minnesota version.
Okay. So we asked the states to report on these key set of metrics.
Do you want to give him one?
And right now we have 30 states that report on these metrics. And as I described earlier, they're simple. There's only 12. They're the kinds of things that, as policymakers, you would want to know. How long does it take for students to get a degree? How many credit hours does it take? Interesting, you talked about the pipeline earlier. It shows you a pipeline, students starting from high school, going through college, and the chair had said you're working on a longitudinal data system. This is what longitudinal data systems will show students starting in high school, how they progress all the way through college. And so we collect data like this from 30 states that we work with out of the 33 states. So we would encourage Minnesota to participate with us in collecting this data and reporting it. And it's a powerful tool for you and for other people in Minnesota to help work on policy change. Otherwise, we wouldn't know how many students were in remediation, how many were getting through the first math class, how many credit hours they were earning.
So is it Dr. Jones?
Just Stan.
Stan. Okay, fine. We know that right now you don't have access to Minnesota data, and I know folks from the Office of Higher Ed are sitting in the audience listening to this presentation. We're not going to put anybody on the spot today, but we will at a hearing in a few weeks from now be asking for an update on where we are with both SLEDS and with our getting ready report. And when we do that, I guess what I would ask the Office of Higher Ed is to let us know if when we have both of those, let us know, will we then have the data that they're looking for? And is there something that we should be doing legislatively to make sure as fast as possible we can get the data to you? Because we want to see how Minnesota fares compared to other states. I would assume people around the table would share that view, that you want to be able to compare Minnesota's performance to the other states that they're tracking. So, yes, nods.
Well, and I would say, too, is that once you look at your data, and this happened in state after state after state, people had no idea how many students were on remediation, no idea that a lot of more recent high school graduates, and no idea that it wasn't working. They all thought, well, remediation works. And so unless you have the data, you can't have that discussion. And we would have faculty members sit like this and say, well, it works at our school. And once they saw their data and recognized that it didn't work, that's when you could have the conversation. So it's important. Across the country, people have different kind of data systems. Many states were not collecting some of these parts, but they thought it was important, like how long does it take? And so they asked for colleges to provide survey data, aggregate data, to get a start until they could start to change their system. So we would love to have you participate with us in that. Thank you, Chair.
Very good. Thank you. Yes. Senator Sheeran.
Just to make sure I understand, when you're talking about these clusters, meta majors,
yes,
and then you go to the block, the student has selected one of these clusters, and then you design in a – you give them a class – this is – you called it the milestone map, academic map.
Right.
For how you move that through in 2 years or 4 years or whatever it is for that cluster. And then you –
they don't have to be in a block. It could just be a schedule of courses. It doesn't have to be in a block. Their map could be taken traditionally like they do now Monday, Tuesday, Thursday. Or we're recommending for some students they could take it in a block.
Okay, so but I guess I got lost on that a little bit. But this block offers them full-time mornings or full-time afternoons. So it allows if they need to work or do a schedule like that, but it really designs the courses for them in a more structured way. They can see the progression. They can... The system designs the courses in a way so that they can take them in this way, and you get better outcomes as a result of that.
Yes, and I'm glad you brought up the work part because people say, well, a lot of students work. Well, 70% of the students that work so they can go to school. So they're likely working at McDonald's or being a clerk at a local hotel, minimum wage jobs, so they can afford to go to school. And so when you do the block, it actually, like you said, helps them. So if they have a morning block, they can work afternoons and evenings. If you have child care issues, that also helps you that way. It helps commuters. So rather than having to come back and forth to campus or having dead time between classes, you're in a block and you're done.
And may I follow up, yes. Senator Bonoff?
Senator Sheeran.
I think that makes a lot of sense, and I can tell you that I think it means that the systems, the educational systems, have to make their course offerings established in a way that this is achievable. Otherwise, you're looking all over for when can I fit a course in. And the other, I just want you to know that when I a million years ago went through my undergraduate degree, I had an academic map for nursing. Mm-hmm. It was absolutely essential, or I wouldn't have been able to make it, not because I wouldn't have been able to, but it just is that complicated a set of courses that it makes it work because you can't get the obligations met unless you have it mapped out ahead of time. You can't play games with, is the course available? Right. Can I get into the course? Putting off an essential chemistry or biology or mathematics course can throw you off a whole semester if you can't get into the class. So, I think there's a lot of really positive things about this.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And just to be clear, you can have a map without a block, or you can have a map with a block.
Mm-hmm.
And an example, Georgia State, which I referenced, they gave incoming freshmen a choice. They say we have a morning block, an afternoon block, and a Tuesday, Thursday block. And 70% of the incoming freshmen chose to take one of those blocks. And so a lot of students would rather do this than have their schedule spread across the week.
And
Senator Sheeran.
You said you didn't have to have the block. You could have something different than that, but you still have prescriptive courses. It's still prescriptive, and you still have to have access to these courses in this order.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
In order to be successful for completion. If you have to muck around and put something off because you can't get into a course, then that just throws this whole system off, right?
Exactly. And as I also described, many of these at-risk students are on financial aid, and they have to have 12 credit hours to qualify for Pell. And if they can't get the courses they need, then some of them take courses they know they don't need so they can qualify for financial aid. And you don't want that to happen either.
Madam Chair, if I could add just one other thing. I think the other advantage of this is if students decide on their path right away, that tells the colleges several semesters down the road when students are going to arrive at certain points on their path, and that's going to help them with scheduling their courses. They'll know how many sections they need to have so they're not scrambling. It creates all kinds of efficiencies if you know exactly when your students are going to need what course and when. It allows you to be able to marshal your resources appropriately.
Thank you. Very good. What is your relationship? You mentioned Lumina, and I know that we're very fortunate. I see Susan Hegard's in the room, and she works with Lumina. What is your relationship with Lumina?
So they're one of our funders,
okay,
as well as Gates and several others.
Great.
And Lumina just funded a three-state program, Georgia, Tennessee, and Indiana, to do this guided pathways at scale for public institutions throughout the state, two-year and four-year. And then for some, we'll do the maps, and others will do the block scheduling.
Very good.
Madam Chairman, if you don't mind, I did notice that you're also talking about shared responsibility for remediation. When we started, one of the first things that happens is that sometimes the universities will say, yeah, but it's not really our fault. If we only had better students coming from high school, it's your fault. Then we would do well. But at the same time, and there's some truth to that, but at the same time, they've accepted those students, accepted tuition, and accepted responsibility. And, of course, the students themselves have responsibility. So I'm not suggesting you pass the bill today, but I am suggesting it's a good conversation to have.
Well, thank you very much for being here, and that is the perfect segue into our next subject. So thank you so much, and please do keep us posted as to the work with MNSCU and let us know how that goes.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah. Oh, did you have something?
I'm sorry.
Senator Klassen, before
you
leave.
I was just going to, again, kind of reaffirm, it's always been my belief not every student needs to have math. And when we looked at a lot of the students going to the two-year colleges, they were poor math students in high school. They struggled, and now we're giving them Accuplacer, which is not aligned to what they've been taught in high school, and some of them have there's no reason why they need to take math in many cases. So I really appreciate your presentation. It just reaffirms a lot of things I've thought about for several years. And a lot of graduate schools are going to that block system, the cohorts, especially people, who are doing graduate work in evenings and weekends and so on. So it's certainly something here in Minnesota we're familiar with. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you very much. Great presentation. So we're going to do something a little unorthodox. We're going to talk about a bill that hasn't been introduced, but it's in your packets. So if you would pull out a bill that's entitled A Bill for an Act Relating to Higher Education Regulating the Allocation of Costs for Post-Secondary Remedial Education. And at this time, I'd like to call up the Students for Education Reform, Kenneth Eben, Latasha Grandy, Kulia Pringle. So, members, the Students for Education Reform brought this proposal to me, and I thought it was definitely worth discussing. Wasn't sure how the committee would view it, so thought it was worth taking step one. I've since learned that one of our colleagues is going to introduce it as a bill, and so we'll let him do that, and we'll see how that goes. But for today's purposes of discussions, I would just like the bill before us and let the Students for Education Reform speak about why they think it's so important. And I think it was in keeping with the conversation that we began with College Complete America. So who is going to begin this discussion?
That'll be me.
Okay, so let us know your name for the record, please.
So my name is Kenneth Abon. I'm the state captain for Students for Education Reform, and I just wanted to say thank you, Madam Chair, and the rest of the committee for letting us come to speak to you today. So just to introduce who we are, we are Students for Education Reform. We are a nonprofit organization that organizes college students on college campuses around the inequities in the K-12 education system, because we feel, as the most recent benefactors of the K-12 education system, that we have a voice to say what we felt worked for us and what we felt didn't work for us and why we're able to get to higher ed. And so we have 17 campuses in the state of Minnesota, all across the state. We have a large cohort here in the Twin Cities, but we also go as far as St. Joe's, Duluth. We have a campus out in Concordia, So we are very well spread, and then also we are diverse not only in our student leaders, who make up 80% of our student leaders that come from, I don't know, what's the word? Communities of color, I guess, is the best word to or phrase to describe them. But also our campuses, we have, I come from the University of Minnesota. I'm a junior there. And then we also have a bunch of schools in the MinSCU system, a few vocational schools, and also community colleges. So we are a very diverse group representing a very diverse college base.
Great.
So I wanted to go ahead and start and talk about the issue which was so eloquently transitioned for us, which is remedial courses. And it is a major issue for our base. We know that a lot of our leaders and a lot of our base have had to go through remedial courses, and that is why we came to Senator Bonhoff and wanted to talk about this issue today. And so Tasha is going to go ahead and discuss a little bit more about the issue, and then we're going to tell a few more of our stories. So if you want to go ahead and flip the page, I already kind of very quickly went through who we are. You can take a look later on. But if you want to go ahead and look at the next two pages, the background information, and then also the chart, Tasha will lead us into that next piece.
Hi, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, committee, for having us here today. I am Latasha Gandy, and I'm the Minnesota Program Director for Students for Education Reform. I started off with Students for Education Reform as a student at Metropolitan State University, so I've came up in this organization and very passionate, and thank you guys for giving us this opportunity again. I also wanted to say a lot of our statistics actually came from the Complete College America information. So it was a very big coincidence. We came in here and we're like, hey, they're saying what we have already. So it's perfect. If you look at the background information, we're just going over some information we found both in a MinSCU study that was done in 2008 and also from Complete College America. It was estimated in 2010 that $30 million was spent on remedial courses here in Minnesota alone. And 54% of the community and technical colleges in 2008 were made up of remedial courses for students that they needed to take. So 54% of the attendees in 2008 needed remedial courses, of which 22% were to state universities. So only 22% went off to the University of Minnesota. At the University of Minnesota, 2% of the class members were in those remedial courses for the first 2 years following graduation. And then one of the biggest reasons why remedial courses is such a burden is not only the financial burden that we're all obviously know about, but it's also the emotional toll that comes with remedial courses. I will share my story here with this one because remedial courses is very personal to my heart. I went to Arlington High School, graduated top of my class, 4.2 GPA, was told I was the most likely to succeed, and also told that I did not need to attend school my senior year because I had already had all my credits. I was an AP student, so I was good to go. I then went out and got a job, then tried to go to college and found myself taking remedial courses. So I never was an AP student. I never had a 4.2 GPA on the national standard, and my whole career was a lie. That's how I feel, and that's how I feel today. I also am hurt and disheartened that there was teachers in my school who told me I was an AP student, who told me I would make it to college and be successful without any struggle, and they did it every day for 3 years. It's wrong. It makes you get there to school and makes you feel like college is not for you. And coming from a community of color, that is like the worst thing you could do to a student. They're already told every day that college is not for them. So for them to actually make it to the doors and then find out that they wasn't prepared and that they're not even at the college level to start what they already fought so hard to get to is almost like a shot in the gut. And it's like a reminder that maybe college is not for people of color. So we have to do something about this. And as a state, we've already admitted that the achievement gap is a problem and we need to fix it. And we're all on board to work towards fixing it. But what about the students that we can't help no more? What about the ones that have already left K through 12 and now they're finding themselves in college struggling? We owe it to them. We just simply owe it to them. And it's not anyone's responsibility. It's not anyone's fault. It's all of ours, including mine. And so that's why I fight with Students for Education Reform.
So just one comment on that, you know, and nothing that I can say will make you feel differently, I'm sure, but I hope that one of the things you might have gleaned from what Stan had to say is that perhaps you really were prepared, and perhaps the test that had you in remediation may have not been the appropriate test. Perhaps there was a better path for you than having to be in remediation.
Yes, ma'am, Senator, and I appreciate the comment. I will say that's probably true for my math remediation. It was not true for my English remediation.
Gotcha.
I needed it. I needed it bad.
Well, could we be honest about our shortcomings?
Be honest. There's nothing, I mean, honestly, I have nothing else but to be honest with,
good.
Honest about it. I made it in college and didn't even know where, like, semicommas go.
Gotcha.
You see what
thank
I'm saying?
Thank you. What a I see what you're saying.
Yeah, so yes. It was definitely needed for me.
Okay, thank you.
Yes. My name is Kulia Pringle. I'm sorry, excuse me. Thank you, Madam Chair and the committee for hearing me today. My name is Kulia Pringle, and I'm a graduate student at Metropolitan State University, chapter leader at Metropolitan State University for Students for Education Reform. And my story is similar to Latasha's in that during high school, I assumed that I was okay. I wasn't in AP programs at Central. I went to Central High School. They had Quest programs and IB programs, and I was in both of those programs throughout my high school year. When I got to St. Paul College and I took the assessment testing, I too was entered into remedial courses. Like she said, it's a shot in the gut when you think that you're smart, and then all of a sudden you get to college, and then. When I got to college on a luck. Nobody ever told me that I even had the mind to go to college. So when I did go to college and they told me that I had, you know, I wasn't even ready for college, it was like, should I even be here? And then the financial thing where you have to pay for the courses, they are financial aid, you know, you get money to pay for them, but they don't count towards your class, your coursework or your degree program, and it's another shot again to the gut. It's like, why am I even here? This is not counting towards my courses. I have to pay for it, and they're saying I'm not smart enough. So that's my story.
Well, thank you for sharing your story. So with regard to the proposed legislation.
Right. So as you can see, there are a few other people that wanted to just have one quote to share with you all. On the following page with a few faces on there who couldn't join us today. But with regards to the legislation that we are proposing, it is a shared burden cost for remedial legislation or remedial courses. So it will be one-third put on the student, one-third put on higher ed, and then one-third put on K-12 through the Minnesota Department of Education. So it will be shared accountability through everyone. And we feel very strongly about this idea because, like with both of the stories shared today, we know that it is a very large burden to carry, a financial burden, an emotional burden, and really a course and time burden, because we all know that college is very strenuous and rigorous as is. And so we feel very strongly about this bill, and I think Tasha also wanted to say one more thing about it.
I actually already shared it in my story when I was just talking about the fact that we have to remember, while we're all fighting for the achievement gap and to close it and to serve the children in our schools now, we have to remember that we owe the ones that have already went through the system something. And to begin with, we can tell them we're going to take care of the cost to make sure that you're successful, or to at least ensure that you're at the same like level that everyone else that entered this school building can.
And
it's
so,
a big step.
I'm sorry. Yeah, I thought you were done. Thank you very much. And the proposed legislation in front of you says that the student would pay a third, the high school or district would pay a third, and the higher ed institution would pay a third. Apparently, the colleague of ours who's going to be offering it is switching that to MDE, but that hasn't been introduced in I think I, you know, whatever. I was surprised by that change. Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am very appreciative of this conversation. This year, I decided to ask my district to give me the opportunity to mentor a group of Latina girls in the ninth grade. And I have 17 girls that I visit with every other Thursday. And the first thing that I ask was for their academic records to look at their GPA. So I have a group of 17, and four of them have 4.0. Then I have some in between, but most of them are about 1.2, 1.3. So we have a long way to go in order to get them to have the 3.7 that is required to go to the University of Minnesota. But what I found is exactly what you're saying. You know, the girls are just not taking the classes that are required. And some of the ones that have the higher GPA actually are taking classes that they should have taken a couple of years ago. And so they were shocked when we revealed that to them. And they were just like, what are you saying, you know, that this class is actually a class that we should have taken a long time ago? Nobody has said that to us. So they were very confused around this issue. And luckily for them, this is the ninth grade. So we're working on that, and we're working with the teachers to figure this out. But I think this is a very significant issue in high school. There is a lot of students who really have no idea what they are going through. And ironically, these schools have a lot of counselors and a lot of opportunities. I met with Dr. Johnson. I said, well, you know, they are not involved in any of this. They have no idea that this is available to them and that they should be, you know, counsel on this thing. And so this is a very significant thing, and I think that we really need to pay attention to what is happening with this issue. So thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you.
Thank you. Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, this is something that I've got personal experience with, because I took remedial classes coming out of high school more out of fear than out of need. I didn't trust myself. I didn't have the confidence in myself. I felt like I needed to build it up, and after I got through it, I thought, well, what a waste of time that was. But with that, the question I have is it sounds like you didn't know you weren't prepared, and that troubles me. I spent you guys know this, but I got to tell these guys. I spent 12 years on a school board dedicated to making sure our students were ready to graduate and enter whatever endeavor was in front of them. And can you share with me? Were there any indications that you saw before you got to college through the ACT, SAT, through your standardized test that gave you any sort of indication that you, or even your AP placement tests, right, that gave you any indication that you were being left behind at the high school level?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Pratt. I never took an AP test. Never knew it existed until I was 25 years old. I'll just say that right now. I promise y'all, no one at Arlington took an AP test in the AP house. We never knew it existed. So no, there was no indication. All it was positive reinforcement that I was a good student, that I was top of my class, and that I was going to be successful. That's all it ever was.
Ms. Grandy, I think you're surprising some of us up here. So so you took an AP course, and then you were not told about the opportunity to take the test.
I took all AP courses.
And you never?
I never took an AP test.
And you didn't know that there were AP tests?
No, ma'am.
You don't know.
Chair.
No, ma'am.
Senator Klassen?
The state actually gives school districts money to help.
I'm aware. So Senator Klassen's reminding us that the state provides districts with money for you to take those tests. So that's why you get the gasp up here, because we're just surprised.
I never knew it existed.
Thank you.
And none of my peers did.
Thank you.
Well, Madam Chair, I'm shocked,
Senator,
as well,
Pratt.
Because that was the whole point of my question is and the reason, one of the reasons why you took the ACT or SAT?
ACT.
And how did that turn out?
I got a 19.
Okay.
So that was a clue.
But it's a clue that comes, excuse me, Senator.
Yes, Senator Torres-Ray.
Well, it's a clue that comes too late.
Right.
You see, so I have a junior.
Right.
And hopefully he'll do well in the ACT, but his GPA is very good. It's a
right.
given.
Yeah.
So I know that the girls that I have in my group who are 4.0s are going to have a good ACT, but they have 2 years. So that score, that ACT score that comes when you're graduating, is too late. You already have a GPA that doesn't take you anywhere. So those scores that we get at the end are no good measures. I mean, they are measures that serve us.
And Senator Torres-Ray, I know that you are passionate, but Senator Pratt actually had the floor, and then Senator Sharon was next. Pratt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just want to tag on with what Senator Torres-Ray is saying, because we have plan tests, we have explore tests, we have ACT tests, we have MCAs, we've had grad tests. And I think it goes to some of the discussion we had last year in that we need to make sure our students are proficient before they get the diploma, before they end up in the situation that they are, and not just go back to. And I love the creativity of this, and the accountability of this. And in fact, we talked a little bit about it last year when we were talking about some sort of accountability before you get your high school diploma. So, I think we need to go back to some sort of. Whether it's a minimum ACT or something before you get your high school diploma, because Senator Torres-Ray is right. That was, and as well as you, Madam Chair, there were signs, but unfortunately the signs came too late.
Thank you. Senator Sharon.
I was just going to say to Senator Torres-Ray that what I was hearing from here is that the GPA of 4.0 is no guarantee.
Right.
That if a student is telling us we're getting the grades and I'm getting positive affirmation in advanced placement classes, so you're going to get 4.0 or 3.6 or whatever it is not an indication based on your experience that you're going to perform well on the ACT or any of these measures. So I'm shocked.
Yeah.
I'm shocked at what you're reporting to us here.
This is a very important
and I think we should look into the issue that Senator Claussen raises, which is if we're giving money to schools and they're receiving it and they're not using it for that purpose, I want to know the answer to that. I want to know what schools are not doing this.
So I do as well, and I will work with Senator Torres-Ray and Senator Wieger on that, and I see people nodding in the audience who actually are accountable for communicating back with those districts, and we'll follow up because you startled us into action. So thank you. Senator Claussen.
Well, I'm going to give you the ray of hope. We sometimes do smart things here. Last year, we abolished the current testing system, and we're putting in a new one. And at eighth grade, students will be tested and they will have a college readiness score in the four major areas, math, science, English, social studies. And you'll have a score, and we can identify whether you're college ready at that point. Are you on track to be college ready? If you're not, then we need to do something about that. Remediation, additional work, what have you. We're going to do it again at grade 10, and then we're going to do it again by taking the ACT. And are you in grade 11 or 12? And the question along the way each time is, are you college ready? And if you're not, this will be an indication for school districts to do something about that. And I should say about taking the AP test, the state doesn't provide all of the money. It provides a portion of the money, and then students have to pay out of their pocket a portion of it.
Or the district.
But still, or the district, correct. So, there is money there. And I like Senator Bonner said, I am shocked that nobody in your district is administering in a large school like Arlington AP exams. So thank you.
Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You see, you opened this wonderful conversation. This bill is not about these things.
But worth discussing.
You have an experience that we're struggling with. So I want to be clear, though. Okay. I want to be absolutely clear. We do not lack measures. We don't need another test, because that's where we differ in opinions. It's not that we don't know this. It's just that what we have in place in terms of implementation of the measures that exist is ineffective. That's a completely different thing. Teachers do know through GPA measure that these kids are not taking the right class, that they are not going. Her teachers knew exactly what was happening. She didn't need to take another test. They knew exactly what was going on. But we don't have capacity within the system. It's just like now that I am meeting with these 17 girls in Roosevelt, now they're saying, oh, yeah, right. No, they're not. So I'm saying, this is what needs to happen. Another measure is not what we need. Another test is not what we need. We need to build the capacity within these districts to work with the students to figure out these plans. In fact, we have legislation that says they are supposed to be, you know, put in individualized learning plans, and they do, and nobody knows what they look like. We have so many policies in education in place that have incorporated significant measures to get these done, but it's just simply not happening. It's just not happening. And that's a different conversation. It's not an additional test. It's not an additional measure. It's implementing what we have in a meaningful way so that it is connected to the next step, which will be having a good ACT score so that it gets you to the school where you want to go. And that does not exist. It just isn't there.
Senator Kent.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I want to take this conversation in a slightly different direction that circles back to the original goal that we want every Minnesotan to get a post-secondary certification and the 75% requirement for our workforce. And I said this in an earlier meeting today, talking about the earlier end of the educational spectrum. We need that as a state. And the demoralization part that you were talking about is critical because you are all motivated individuals. You have been working hard. Things have failed you along the way. We can't then say, throw up our hands and go, we're done. And absolute congratulations to each of you for continuing to fight for yourselves. This is too important, and we need to recognize that just drawing lines and saying you're in, you're out, that's not okay either. You know, we have got to figure out a way to really address these issues, as Senator Torres-Ray is talking about, and come up with some meaningful solutions, because we need all of our students to be ready to work and to go. Thank you.
And just to complete this part of the discussion, and then because we have another bill up, it's not okay for students of color to have one experience taking an AP course and students who are not, you know, of color, to have a different experience, because there really is a College Board, and an AP class has associated with it an AP test. And so that's what you heard, the shock, you know, was just that inequity of opportunity. So thank you. And I, you know, I was so inspired when you came to my office. That's why you're here on day one of the session. And so you've continued, I can tell, to inspire the rest of the committee. And so we look forward to working with you and expect you to follow the committee the same way many others around here do. And we know you'll come to the table when you have things to say. So thank you very much.
Thank you for your time.
Yeah. Okay. Now we've got Senator Klassen's bill. So we will call on him to present Senate File 403. We're very excited about Senator Klassen's bill. So look forward to hearing about it. And Senator Klassen, I know you've got an amendment, so would you like to present that first, put it before us?
I do, Madam Chair. Again, just for the record, my name is Greg Klassen. I'm a member of the Minnesota Senate, and thank you for the opportunity to appear before the committee today. We do have a delete all memo, amendment, rather. You should have that in your packet. You can take a look at that. Just a little bit of history on this. Senate File 403 was introduced last year during the 2013 legislative session, and it was the intent to study the feasibility of a program that would assist Minnesota residents in refinancing higher education debt. Unfortunately, it didn't gain traction, but on the other hand, it did start communication and people thinking, and so we're back this year with an amendment that you can see there that we think is a good idea. As you heard earlier, Senator Boniff mentioned that we traveled the state. We did 22 town hall meetings, listening sessions, listening to students, and we heard the issue of the high cost of education student debt at every stop we made. And there are a lot of statistics that support that. The average four-year graduate of a higher education institute in Minnesota carries around $30,000 in debt. That's the third highest in the nation. And we have about 71% of our students carrying higher education debt, which is the fifth highest in the nation. So this is a definite issue that we need to address. And this is the first of three bills the committee will be hearing trying to address this issue. From our discussions last year, the Office of Higher Education has stepped forward with a proposal that you see in the Delete All amendment. And I think it's important, as we talk to the students that were just here, that they are making an investment. We, as a state, need to make an investment and make sure for the quality of life that we have, and so we continue to move forward in our state, that we have college graduates that are graduating, they're getting jobs, and at the same time, they're not graduating with a huge debt that they have to take on. So at this time, I'd like to turn the discussion over to two members of the Office of Higher Education, Tricia Grimes, Marilyn Cosser, and they will talk about the proposal, and I'll turn it over to them.
Madam Chair, I'm Tricia Grimes from the Office of Higher Education, and with me is Marilyn Cosser, the manager of our self-loan program, which is a supplemental loan program designed for students who need to borrow more than they can in the federal Stafford loans. Student loan refinancing is a way the Office of Higher Education may be able to help students manage their debt, particularly those that have private loans at higher interest rates. The main way this could happen is that by refinancing their loans, we may be able to get them a somewhat lower interest rate than they currently have, and or we may be able to extend the time in which they have to repay, which would get lower their monthly payment until they're able to pay more. One of the things we have been asked is whether a separate bonding authority would be needed for the proposed refinancing. The answer is no, we do not think so. We currently are authorized in law to have up to $850 million in outstanding student loan bonds at any given time, and we currently have $551 million. So there's about $300 million worth of capacity left there. We plan to do this on start out with the conservative assumptions. If we get the authority to do student loan refinancing, conservative in that we might require a little bit higher credit score to begin with and gain experience with borrowers and see whether, in fact, we can offer an interest rate that's enough lower than what they're currently paying for it to be worthwhile for them to refinance with us. We want to be very clear not to overpromise. There will be some borrowers who have very low income, and even at a reduced interest rate and a longer repayment period of time, they may not be able to afford their payments. And so it is not, we may not, there will be some borrowers we cannot help with this program. But there will be other borrowers we should be able to help. So our idea is that we would essentially kind of dip a toe in the refinancing water, start out with relatively conservative assumptions. When you refinance loans, you're basically refinancing for larger amounts of money than you would as you issue loans to students who are doing it year by year, so that if they default, the default is also a larger amount of money. So we need to be careful about that. Our hope is that as we gain experience with the borrowers over time, that we could loosen up a bit on the kinds of credit scores that would qualify for the program. Okay, so I already talked about the student loan fund. So I'm trying to skip down in my notes here. Just excuse me a minute. We have talked to other state loan programs. There are 16 states that have state loan programs, and several of them are doing limited amounts of student loan refinancing currently. We've looked in particular at the programs offered by Maine, North Dakota, and South Carolina. And the interest rates range from 3.5% for a variable rate loan, which is a very competitive interest rate, to 9.3% for a fixed rate loan once all of the fees are factored in. Typically, what happens with private student loans is that they base the interest rate on the student's credit score and their cosigner's credit score. So if their credit isn't good, they end up paying a higher interest rate. And what we typically do in our programs is we figure out what interest rate, and then we use that interest rate for all borrowers once they meet our credit threshold. We tend to, in the self-loan program, everybody pays the same interest rate. They have to, their cosigner has to have a lack of lots of bad things on their credit. We don't even use credit score in that program at this time. But once they qualify, meet those initial credit standards, everybody pays the same interest rate.
And excuse me, Ms. Grimes, what is the interest rate right now on the self?
Right now, the interest rate in the self-loan program is 3.2% for the variable rate and 6.9% for the fixed rate option. The variable rate option, we reset the interest rate every 3 months. Mm-hmm. And for the last 5 years, it's been between 3 and 3.4%, the variable rate loan.
I'm concerned as I hear you talk about the credit score as a mom of four young adult kids. My kids still don't have, I mean, my oldest do, but the ones just out of college don't have credit scores yet because they don't have credit. So
With the self-loans that we currently do, these are not the refinance loans, but they're the self-loan program that we currently run and have been running for more than 25 years, we do not actually check a credit score on the borrower. We check the credit score on the cosigner because many times the borrowers do not have credit history yet. When we do the reloan refinancing program, we anticipate that we would be looking at the credit score of both the borrower and the cosigner.
And again, Ms. Grimes, given the concern around the fact that they probably won't have a credit score at this point, do you expect that, let's say, the cosigner, and I'm also interested in whether Senator Klassen thinks that these borrowers will have cosigners, but let's say they have a cosigner and their cosigner has a credit score that would be acceptable, and the student themselves doesn't have a credit score, would they, because of that combined fact, would they have a higher interest rate than your lower interest rate availability?
Madam Chair, I don't think so. My if we do this program the way we do the self-loan program, which is what I understand, once we would have some kind of credit history or threshold they would have to meet. If they had an absence of bad credit, for example, that might be enough as long as their cosigner had a good credit score. But once they met that initial credit score threshold, we would charge them all the same interest rate.
Gotcha.
Is that clear, I hope? As we would get going with this program, we think it would take us a minimum of 9 months to begin offering the loan refinancing because there are a number of things we would have to get in place. It would be somewhat labor intensive. We would need to verify what all the borrower's existing loans are, who would have to be repaid off when we replace those existing loans with a new loan. We would have to have a series of forms and the states that are currently doing this are not automating much of it. They're doing an awful lot of it by hand because each individual borrower situation is different from the previous ones. And so the opportunity for efficiencies only develops once you've been running the program for a while. I wanted to mention there the Federal Consumer Financial Protection Bureau has made a couple of statements encouraging lenders to offer refinancing. They said in a report in July 2013, consumers continue to complain that they are unable to modify the repayment terms of their loan, either in order to lower monthly payments during periods of financial hardship or to reflect the borrower's improved credit profile and creditworthiness. They also said many consumers seek to negotiate for a more affordable payment plan on their loan obligations, only to find themselves stymied, even when a modification would make sense for all concerned parties, both the lender and the borrower. So we hope to be able to help people, at least some of the borrowers that would be in this situation. One other reason sometimes students want to refinance is because they want to remove one cosigner and perhaps replace that cosigner with another. For example, if their cosigner was a spouse and it's 10 years later and they're divorced, they may want to replace that cosigner with a brother or a parent or something like that. And if with existing loans, it's very difficult to change cosigners, if not impossible.
Senator Clausen, will you move the amendment just so we have it before us in the proper form?
Thank you. Madam Chair, I move we adopt the amendment to Senate File 403.
All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion is adopted. Thank you. Senator Lurie.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Senator Clausen, and testifiers. I mean, I'm just taking a quick read of this amendment, and it's breathtaking in the scope of authority we just hand over to the Office of Higher Ed. I mean, I am reading the bill that was originally drafted. I see several good questions that just jump out at me to that kind of require an answer, and they're not at all. And you know, I don't know what pot of money these loans would be made out of. Is there a fiscal note that's going to be associated with this ever? I mean, and you've got four very specific questions that were, you know, that initially were going to be studied and reported back to the legislature so that there was some parameters around this. I mean, this is just go do good. I mean, it's... Can you address that?
And Senator Lurie, one of the reasons why we have somebody from the self-loan program, which we do, actually, you know, that's part of everyday practice so that we can hear a little bit more about the capacity of the Office of Higher Ed, what they're currently doing and what their experience is in this area.
So, Mr. Chairman, Madam Chair and Senator, I will start out and then I will ask Marilyn Kozer to chime in. We have what's called our student loan fund. Our student loan fund, it would be the source of funding for these refinance loans. Our student loan fund is currently used to make our self loans, which are supplemental loans for students. The proceeds in the student loan fund came from tax exempt revenue bonds that we got allocations from the state for, taxable revenue bonds, repayments from previous borrowers, and interest earnings. So that's the source of funding. The total amount of outstanding bonds we have from all the loans that we have out now over the many years we've been operating the program is $550 million. There is a statute that says we cannot exceed $850 million total outstanding authority. In recent years, our volume in the SELF program has declined, partly because the federal government increased the amount that students can borrow through the Stafford Loan Program, and that program is the one borrowers should always use first because it has the most flexible repayment terms. Also, however, the federal government has restricted what schools can tell students about any loan that's not a federal loan. And that has contributed to the decline in volume in our self-loan program. The original bill basically asked us to do a feasibility study. We talked to the other states about that. And they, because normally in a program like this, you would hire someone like Springstead Associates to do a feasibility study. There are so many unknowns in this endeavor. What the borrower's credit scores are going to be, what their current debt is outstanding, to whom they owe that current debt, what their, you know, repayment history is, so forth. The states that are doing it in very limited volume, probably less than $10 million a year. And what they basically decided to do was bite the bullet and start doing it on a limited basis and see how it goes, because their advisors told them they really couldn't do a feasibility study. There were just too many unknowns.
Senator Lurie.
Madam Chair, in an environment with so many unknowns, I don't know if that actually gives me comfort to vote in favor of something with such incredibly broad discretion, with no legislative input at all about how this would be implemented. I mean, it troubles me some. I'd like to have, and so other states have adopted a small manageable. This isn't necessarily small or manageable. I couldn't quite tell if there's a capacity of your loaning of 850 and you have 550 million outstanding. I mean, I hear 300 million outstanding able to be loaned with no guidance to, I mean, and I don't know if I did that math quite right.
Madam Chairman,
Ms. Grimes,
Senator Lurie, much of our existing set of loans is pledged to bond covenants for the bond revenue bond issues that they are essentially collateral for.
Mm-hmm.
We basically have about $100 million that is not pledged to one of those existing bond covenants. We are currently using about $60 million to loan out a year to loan out for our self loans. And so we assume that there would be about up to $40 million a year that could be used for these kinds of refinanced loans. We also anticipate that we would regularly update the committee on how the program is developing. Frankly, we would prefer to have a couple of years before we would have to do a formal report, because if it's going to take us at least 9 months to begin offering the loans, then by the end of 2 years, we would have about a year's experience with people repaying the loans.
Senator Lurie, it was our intention to move the bill to the finance. Right now we're hearing this in policy, to move the bill to the finance side of the House and then submit it for a fiscal note and get input from MMB. And so that was going to be the next step of the loan. I think we were interested and have been working pretty closely. Senator Klausen's working with John Fuller, who had to go oversee a conference committee. So we're joined by Lexi Stengel, which we appreciate. But Mr. Fuller could have given you a broader overview of the kind of work he's been doing on this. So I think that that he has been working closely with the folks of Office of Higher Ed, and we did think the next step was to get more input from the finance side of our state agencies. Have you, Ms. Grimes, that was our intention. Have your folks talked to MMB?
Madam Chair, we have not talked to MMB about this particular, I should not say that. In our original agency unsession bill, we did have this very similar language. And MMB did not raise objections. They did want to make sure that we would be regularly reporting and have oversight on the program.
Senator Lurie.
Chair, there's no oversight or reporting
That's
in this language in front of us at all. I mean, if I were MMB, I don't know how I'd approach putting a fiscal estimate behind this. I'd have to estimate the maximum amount, and then so many unknowns. I don't know if the assumptions that you'd make, the borrowers would actually be able to make the payments or not. I mean, I don't know anything from this. I'd have a hard time if I were MMB, but we'll get a fiscal note. And
Senator Torres Ray, and then Senator Sharon. But I actually would like to have I'm sorry, say your name again.
Marilyn Kosher.
Ms. Kosher, talk to us about the self loan. So would you do that before we take further questions?
Madam Chair, excuse me. The self program has been in operation since 1984. And as Ms. Grimes said, our volume was at a higher level a few years ago, but because of the preferred lender, we're down to roughly $60 million a year. We do have the 3.2% variable rate, the 6.9% fixed rate. We charge the same interest rate to all of our students, whether they pick the variable or fixed rate. We do require a cosigner on all of our loans. That really has kept the cost down by reducing the defaults on the loan. And again, we don't look at a FICO score at this time. We just look at basic credit, so you can have liens, judgments, collection items on your credit report. And again, that's only on the cosigner. We're not looking at the borrower's credit report. Our loan limits are $7,500 per year for students in non-4-year programs, and they're $10,000 per year in students in 4-year or graduate programs. So we have annual limits. We have cumulative limits, so up to $50,000 for undergraduate four-year, $70,000 cumulative undergraduate graduate for, again, students that attended four-year colleges.
Ms. Kozier, what are our default rates?
Madam Chair, the default rates are roughly 6 to 7% overall, but that's a gross default. After our collection efforts, we're down to less than 2%. Again, by having the cosigner, we have tools to use against both borrower and cosigner. We're able to utilize the revenue recapture interception for Minnesota tax refunds. We also utilize the services of the Minnesota Department of Revenue for collection of debts that we can't collect ourselves.
And Ms. Kozier, how many staff people do you have in your department that run this program?
Madam Chair, just in strictly the self-loan department, including myself, there's five people. We take care of all of the origination of the new loans. We do all the processing of that. Then we also take care of a collection of the defaulted loans from my staff.
And what kind of certification do you and your staff have? Are you certified? You know, is there some kind of a license that you have to be able to do this work?
No, Madam Chair, since we are not official collectors, we're not a third-party collector, we don't need debt collection licensing. Mm-hmm. Since we're collecting on our own debt, we don't have to have that. So basically, we originate the loans. That's, again, where we approve them. We do have a third-party servicer that takes care of all the billing for us, all the collection, everything, unless it goes into default. Then when it comes back to us, we do letters from our office. We do the tax filing, but we really are not staffed up for full force skip tracing and collection, so that's where we use the Minnesota Department of Revenue or private collection agencies.
Madam Chair, to just give a little bit of an order of magnitude, currently about 4% of Minnesota post-secondary students use the SELF program. At its height, it was more like 11%. So it's sort of a limited population that is using this program. It just so happens that the people who answer the phones about defaulted loans sit outside my office, so I hear their phone calls every day. And we work really hard with borrowers to try to avoid sending them to collection. We will, if they have defaulted, we will work with them to try to get them to rehabilitate their loan. If they make those payments, they work with us on agreeing on an amount that they can afford to pay. Once they've made those payments for 12 months, we report that to the credit agency, and so the default is much less. Basically, the item on their credit report shows that they're now in good standing and making payments on that loan. The other thing we do is we do payment agreements with them, again, to try to get an agreement between us and the borrower or us and the cosigner on what they can afford to pay. And we will sometimes accept very modest payments because we would rather get some money from the borrower than have to send them to either revenue recapture through the Department of Revenue or to collection agency.
Gotcha. And I know I had called on Senator Torres Ray, and I had called on Senator Sharon, and Senator Miller also has his hand up, and I know he's leaving in 5 minutes, so I wondered if you two would allow him to ask his brief question.
Oh, it's not brief.
Well, you said you're leaving, so I assumed it was brief.
thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Kozier, what is the current default rate on the current student loan program?
Roughly around 6%. That's the gross default, and then after our collections, a little under 2%.
Okay, and Madam Chair and Ms. Kozier, what do you anticipate the same type of default rate if we if this program expands and goes into this other loan program?
Madam Chair, Senator Miller, the difference we look at is these will be larger loans, so the chance, if you have a default, it will be larger. We have heard from some of the other states that so far their experience has been that people that tend to go through the refinancing may tend to, and especially if they've completed their degrees, are a better credit risk. Some of the other states have seen and have seen actually lower default rates. But again, we are concerned that the dollar amounts would be higher on a refinanced loan.
Okay, and Madam Chair and Ms. Kozier, what would happen? What safeguards will be in place, or what would the results be if the default rates are going a little bit higher than expected, and the amount of funds in the program decrease as a result of that? What safeguards would be in place? Who would be on the hook for those funds?
Madam Chair, Senator Miller, I think one of the things we've looked at is having the flexibility to make changes. I mean, that's where if we're seeing that the default rate is too high, maybe our credit criteria needs to be adjusted. Do our limits need to be adjusted? But that's where we've heard from other states that having flexibility is very important to be able to make changes as needed. Again, there is no general fund money for the program, so the defaults, when we issue our bonds, you know, we have requirements of reserves that we have to maintain for defaulted loans, and those are, you know, reviewed based on our defaults. If it's determined we need to adjust them, you know, we have our accountants recommend changes.
Madam Chair, if I could just provide a little bit of perspective on the default rate. Our default rate of 6% is over the lifetime of the loan. When you hear federal student loan default rates, those are for the first 2 years of the first 3 years of payment, so that they would be higher rates if they were computed over the whole life of the loan.
And Madam Chair and
Senator Miller, you're wearing out your welcome for
this is the last one. Right. This is the last one, then I'm out the door. You guys will get rid of me. So I'm going to try to get home and tuck my three boys into bed. We'll see if it
three boys under it, age two.
Yeah, see if it happens. So I just want to be very clear that no general fund dollars would be accounted for in this program. And I do want to express my concerns. I think Senator Lori hit on a lot of them. I think the idea in general is a good idea, but we still have some work to do, and I think the oversight is a big deal, and it'll be interesting to see what MMB does bring back. So this will go to the Finance Division of the Higher Education Committee. Okay, thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Klassen.
If I could just comment. I think the last few minutes of discussion here relates back to why there aren't a lot of real specifics in the bill, because you know, the default rates and different things, there's no guarantee on the self loans right now.
Right.
It's very similar. What we're doing, though, is trying to move in a different direction to help students who have accumulated debt for higher education costs. And I think this is a trial in many ways, but we've got other states that have done it. We've got a history of the self loan, and there's not a lot of difference here between the self loans that we're doing and what we're proposing here. So.
And it looks like Senator Klassen, when it gets to finance, will want to recommend that you consider an amendment that would provide some timely oversight and where that oversight would come from. So I would suggest that. Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Klassen or Ms. Grimes, I have a kind of a problem with kind of the broad language that is in here, and I want to understand this, because part of the issue that I obviously understand is that you want to know that in the proposal the refinancing terms would be more beneficial, that you obviously want to move in a direction to support the student and the family. However, that language is just not here. So I suggest, Senator Klassen, that be stated in the legislation, because that's where you want to go. Because it could very well be, just like in healthcare in other areas where, you know, the process is handed on to some financial institutions that want to see more profit in the future, and the refinancing conditions that are offered are not beneficial. So I think it should be stated in legislation that the new terms and conditions should clearly demonstrate economic benefit, because if not, it could go in the opposite direction. And I know that's not the intent. Of course, you want to help negotiate better terms. So that's one question and one suggestion I have. The other one is really who's responsible for triggering the process? You have full responsibility. I think about a refinancing process that I went through with my bank with our house, which the benefits were so much better for us. But the bank actually sent a letter saying, you know, you could renegotiate the terms of your home, of your loan, because your credit record and blah, 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 allow, you know, will get you a better rate. And so we did. And I am not clear in here. It seems like you make that determination and you do it on behalf of these individuals. Or could you explain how the process works? Because I feel that having that absolute authority to not only go into negotiating new terms, but also kind of doing it unilaterally seems like a tremendous amount of power that your customer needs to kind of share on that. So I don't know how that the actual process works right now, but I do think that this needs to be part of the legislation.
Madam Ms. Chair, Grimes. Senator Torres-Ray, there is language in the same group of statutes on our self loan that we are to report material changes to the program to the chairs and ranking minority members of the legislature. And, for example, the last time we did that was when we sold bonds. There was still a lot of uncertainty that the was a couple of years ago when they thought the economy might get better fast. And so our fixed rate loan was at 7.25%, even though we would have preferred to have it lower than that. As a couple of years went by, we were able to change that to 6.9%. And so we sent a letter that said we thought this was a material change in the program, and we were advising people that we were making that change. We would anticipate doing that kind of thing with this program also.
Madam Chair?
Senator Torres-Ray.
But that report is to us. I am just talking about kind of your relationship with the student and the family in this situation, which, you know, kind of creates a mechanism to inform the individual about the, you know, this process, which is of benefit, is what you're saying. But I think it needs to be clearly stated.
Yes.
Well, here.
Senator Torres-Ray, what I hear you saying is you'd like to see something that directs the Office of Higher Ed to only make the refinancing if it's advantageous terms to the borrower.
Exactly.
So you don't want to have the Office of Higher Ed refinance a loan that could, in fact, cost the borrower more. And you want to make sure that there's certainty around that. Is that what I hear
you
saying?
That's exactly right, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Chair, Senator, we would like to work on language that would work in that direction. I have to tell you that it's a little bit delicate because sometimes if what you are doing is extending the repayment period, that means that there will be longer, more interest cost to the borrower. And it could be debatable whether that's better terms or not. Now, that might be what the borrower needs in order to make the payments in the short term and be able to sort of afford the rest of their life. But it could be debatable whether that's to the economic benefit of the borrower or not, because they would, in fact, be paying more interest because they'd be paying longer.
So we trust that you will use your creativity as you work with Senator Claussen so far on the one or two or three amendments that we may roll into one as we go forward. Senator Sharon.
I don't think I need – I think that the point is being made. That, I'd be interested in seeing the language that we use to develop the SELF program, what parameters we placed in the language that set a structure around this rather than simply a blanket authority like this that's making us uncomfortable. I don't think that's what we did when we initiated the SELF program. And I'm just advising Senator Claussen that we need some assurances that there are some parameters around what are done. And then if there are significant movements or changes away from that, a deadline or a reporting time to us that there have to be some changes in those parameters or in the way that this is rolling out. I think that absolutely has to be part of this when it gets into the Finance Committee. And I love this concept. I think it's really ripe and needed, but we have to be responsible about how we roll it out.
Great. Senator Lurie.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I guess that's a lot of what I was going to say is I'd like to see, we've had described to us, and first off, I'll take Senator Sharon's final comment as well. I did neglect to say I am very supportive of the concept of helping students refinance loans that they're struggling with. It is a very important thing that we need to pay attention to, and I neglected to say that in my initial comments. But we had described to us a whole set of criteria applied to the self loan, the cosigner, the loan limits, the annual limits, the material change requirements, some of the oversight and reporting requirements. But I don't believe any of that, the way I read this, would apply to this new loan program. And so what we had described is maybe a decent set of frameworks. Maybe some of it works, maybe some of it doesn't for this program, but I see none of that structure here, and so would like that just borne out a little bit or be corrected. I mean, maybe some of the self-loan requirements actually are adopted here, and we're just not seeing it on this page. No, they're not. No. Okay. I think we probably would like to see some additional parameters put in place to make sure that this really is a good investment.
Well, I think this is going to end up being one of the more important pieces of legislation we're going to grapple with, so I think it's appropriate that we take a lot of time and that we do move it to the Finance Committee so that we can get the financial answers that we all want, and then to allow you, Senator Clausen, some time to digest what the will of the committee is and some time to work with counsel. And I know Lexi Stengel, I've worked closely with on other issues. I know she will be happy to work with you as well as John Fuller and Trish Grimes. So any comments for you, Senator Clausen?
No, I appreciate those comments, Madam Chair. I think that's good advice, and we certainly can work on this. Again, this was something that we tried to work on last year. I think I have to give a lot of credit to the Office of Higher Education to come back and say, hey, that's a good idea. We've talked about it. We'd like to move ahead. Yeah. But we're also in uncharted waters here to some degree. Yeah. And we're going to be cautious. We've had those discussions. And right now, there needs to be a little bit, I think, what you're asking for is more firm information about exactly how this is going to work, and we can work on that.
Great. Sure. So you want to move the bill to finance?
We actually have two additional groups that would like to testify.
Oh, okay, very good. Right? Sorry about that.
I'd like to, we have some representatives from Minnesota Student Association I'd like to call up, and then we also have Minnesota Private College Council here. So.
Yes.
Madam Chair, I would vote yes if I were here to move it to finance.
Yeah, very good. Okay, good. Thank you.
That's right. Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Matt Forstey. I serve as the chair of the Minnesota Student Legislative Coalition. I'm a senior at the University of Minnesota, and so I represent students from across the state.
Good to see you again, Matt. Welcome back.
Good to see you as well. I also serve on the Officer Higher Education Student Advisory Council, so I've had a chance to discuss this proposal at some length with them in that context as well. So as this committee knows, I've been following this committee for well over a year. I know that you know that student loan debt is out of control and is one of the biggest issues facing higher ed, as well as my generation and people that are 10 years older than me and probably 10 people that are 10 years younger than me down the road. And so that's why we're here today. That's why we support this idea. And of course, as we move forward, I think we would be very interested in not only working on this bill and this idea, but addressing student debt in a more full sense. And we do recognize the progress that has been made over the past year or so with freezing tuition and providing more money in the state grant program. But we definitely believe that there's more to be done. So with that, I will turn it over to Joel Stengler to provide some more.
And Matt, we welcome your ideas as we go. So thank you for that testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Matt. My name is Joelle Stengler. I'm a sophomore at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities. I'm studying statistics and political science, and I grew up in Rogers, Minnesota. My parents are both educators, and upon graduation, I will likely be $27,000 to $30,000 in debt. And that's just the principal. With the interest, I'll be paying a lot more. We want to thank the committee for considering options to relieve the strain that student loan debt is placing on a generation of students. Senate File 403 is a good step, and we look forward to working with the committee to explore other ideas. I would like to talk briefly about student loan debt and its impact on my generation and our society. Debt has become the buzzword of our generation. When I started college, I had no idea about the implications of interest and what my loans really meant. I currently receive four subsidized, unsubsidized, and Parent Plus loans, and have looked into the Minnesota self-loan once I learned of its existence. Each caps at a different rate, and each has a different loan rate or loan limit. The variety is very confusing, and the end result of debt per student is overwhelming. Now, what does this debt look like to an 18-year-old freshman who still has 4 years ahead at the university? It's books I didn't buy because that money could be going towards paying off interest. It's 15 to 20 hours a week I worked in an on-campus job as a freshman, plus weekends taking up tables waiting in my hometown to be able to afford to be in debt. And I think that's really important, that I have to afford to be able to afford to be in debt. Yeah. It's internships that I've turned down because most are unpaid, and study abroad opportunities that I have forgone and will continue to forego because that time not spent working is more debt accumulating. It's my parents who have worked in education their whole lives, having to rethink their passions. Because college is such a financial burden on my family. It's a mother leaving her job as a fifth grade teacher. And a dad continuing to go to schools to defer his loans to help me. My dad's been in school for like 15 years. He will be in school for like 15 more years. As you can see, Minnesota students, graduates, and most importantly, families are struggling with inflexible debt obligations. As you likely know, the students that borrow at the University of Minnesota, their average debt is just shy of $30,000, and I fall right into that category. So I'm right around the average. But I am one of many students who will be heading into a recovering job market with that debt hanging over my future. We should and need to take action, and we need to take any action that we can to relieve the debt burden for current and future college graduates. Giving the Office of Higher Education the latitude to refinance loans when it makes sense is a good step. We urge you to support the Senate file, and we look forward to working with the committee and the Office of Higher Education in the future to reduce student loan debt. Thank you for your time.
Ms. Thangler, thank you for sharing your story. And, you know, on behalf of a generation of policymakers that put that kind of burden on you students, you know, we are sorry that that has occurred. And we are doing our very best to craft a way to change that trajectory. So thank you. Paul Cervenek.
Thank you. Thanks very much. Good job.
It really is.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Paul Cervenek. I'm the president of the Minnesota Private College Council. And I appreciate the opportunity to be here today to indicate the support of Minnesota's private nonprofit colleges for Senator Claussen's proposal. I'll just tell you briefly that we've been hearing for a number of years from our campus financial aid offices about the declining use of the self-loan program among our students. And our financial aid advisors are concerned about that because they understand that the self-loan program is a wise option for students who feel they need to borrow beyond what's available at the federal, in the federal loan programs. And, of course, under the federal lending requirements, our colleges are limited in what they can tell students about their borrowing options. If they could say more, they would tell students to use the Minnesota loan program if they need to do additional borrowing. So we see this bill as a way for the Office of Higher Education to maybe deal with those students who didn't get good information and took on maybe some private borrowing that did not have as favorable terms as they might have obtained if they had had the information about the self-loan program in the first place. So we think this is a good step in the right direction in terms of dealing with the college affordability challenge that students face, and we appreciate the support of senators for this bill. And we really appreciate Senator Claussen's work and the work of the House of Higher Education on it.
Mr. Cervenek, thank you very much. And I wrote a letter to Senator Franken, and asked, with the help of the Office of Higher Ed, and asked Senator Franken to, and we sent it to Senator Klobuchar too, but Senator Franken's on the committee, and I talked to his assistant to say, please change the laws that don't allow, you know, our institutions to tell students about more favorable rates. I think we could use some more lobbying on that effort because it wasn't received with, like, the warmest welcome. And, you know, and their concerns were states that don't have the kind of track records that Minnesota does. But, you know, perhaps a waiver might be a way to go if there are concerns on behalf of other states. And so maybe we could work around talking about how to advocate differently on that score. So thank you.
Thank you for doing that, and I want you to know I was in D.C. about a month ago talking with our members of Congress about exactly the same thing and making exactly the same suggestions, including a waiver process for states that have demonstrated they're running responsible and reliable programs like ours. So
well, let's work together on that.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you, Senator Klassen.
Yes.
Yeah. So,
yes, Madam Chair, I move we approve.